Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Tim Sullivan. Tim has been employed by the Chicago Zoological Society at Brookfield Zoo for the last 39 years. He spent 16 years as a keeper/trainer in the Marine Mammal Department, training and caring for the zoo's dolphins, walrus, sea lions, and seals. In 1997, Tim was asked to implement an elephant-protected contact behavior management program in the pachyderm department, and then in 1998, he was offered his present position as the zoo's curator of behavioral husbandry. Tim's primary responsibilities are to manage the zoo's animal training and environmental enrichment programs, oversee the behavior of the zoo's large and diverse animal collection, from aardvarks to zebras, and is responsible for developing the skills of over 100 animal keepers who care for them. Tim consults on animal training and environmental enrichment at other zoological institutions and conducts international training workshops. Tim is currently on the instructor team of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, AZA, annual animal training applications and environmental enrichment in zoos and aquariums courses. He is active in international training organizations and has been an officer on the board of directors of both the International Marine Animal Trainers Association, IMATA, and the Animal Behavior Management Alliance, an organization he co-founded. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Tim Sullivan to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. And patience, a word that I don't use lightly today, because it's taken us an hour of technical gremlins to connect today. So thank you very much, Tim, for your patience, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks so much. It's an honor to be here.
It's an absolute honor to have you. And I did not know that you, I only learned this when I read your bio, that you co-founded the ABMA. Wow.
Yeah, it was a dream of several marine mammal trainers. We started to realize that the knowledge that we had acquired and practiced for decades in the marine mammal community could really benefit other animals in zoos. And there seemed to be a thirst for that knowledge out there. You know, several of us had kind of spread our wings a little bit and helped out in different areas when behavior problems popped up or interest in training started. And we said, wow, this would be great. There should be an organization kind of like the Marine Mammal Trainers Organization or the Bird Trainers Organization to go out there and work with zoo animals. And we decided one day just give it a shot, and it all came together and has been flowing ever since.
That's amazing. When was this?
We started talking about it in the I think it was probably the late 1990s. We had our first kind of test conference at the Cincinnati Zoo in 1999, and then we incorporated the organization in that year. I believe the bylaws were signed in the year 2000. So it's been going strong for almost 20 years now.
Yeah, amazing. We've had numerous, actually, presidents of ABMA on the podcast show.
You have.
So nice to tie it back to its roots. Are you still involved in ABMA? Have you taken a bit of a step back?
I stepped back from board activities because you always want to allow for new blood to come into an organization to take the blinders off and really move forward. But I'm always there to assist the board in just kind of decisions that are coming up, to give sage advice if asked. And I always stay connected to the organization because it's kind of like one of your children. You want to see it keep going. You're proud of it. And I really love what they're doing, kind of spreading the animal training knowledge and positive reinforcement across zoos and aquariums.
We talk about ripples on this show and those small things you do that sends out waves into the world. So that's a mighty fine ripple, if I do say so myself.
And congratulations to you, this compendium of just amazing speakers you've had on your podcast show. I can't tell you how important that is to document and archive all that knowledge that's out there, because this is really about spreading the information about what we do and how to help people. And you've created this online mentorship, which I think will live forever. And I think it's going to do some great things. And your ripple is pretty big. You should be proud.
Way to go. Turn that back around on me. Thank you. I'm blushing here, everyone. Hey, thanks for that, Tim. That's really nice. Hey, I'm keen to talk more about this, but before we do, maybe we'll kind of go backwards and then come back to this over the next wee bit of this episode. But I'm curious to learn now where you got started, Tim. Can you take us back to young Tim Sullivan before you ever trained an animal? How did you first learn about positive reinforcement? How did you get into doing this? And can you share some stories from your early days?
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like my life is a little like Forrest Gump. I've just stumbled into some amazing opportunities that have worked out really well for me. Back when I was a wee 17 years old in high school, I worked at a Burger King as a swing manager. And the owner of the store said, "Tim, you're such a great employee. Someday this is going to be your store." And I had this lightning bolt hit me and said, "Holy crap, I don't want to work at a Burger King my whole life." And I quit the next day and I had no job. I needed money. And so I was talking to my parents and we lived maybe 10 minutes down from the Brookfield Zoo. And they said, "Well, you love animals. Why don't you see if you can get a job there?" And as it turns out, I happen to know someone that worked there. And when I was applying for a job, I thought the working with the dolphins would be a really cool job. As a teenager, it seems really pretty awesome. And so I didn't know what it was called. So I said, "I want to be a dolphin attendant." And the receptionist there said, "Well, listen, you know what? They're hiring one right now. And the curators are upstairs. Maybe if he comes down, you can give you an interview." And that's how it turned out. And after about a couple hours of discussion, I had myself a part-time job taking tickets and scrubbing algae in the pools and really falling in love with animal training, especially with marine mammals. And I said, "Well, I didn't have a career objective at the time, but now I do." And I set my sights on trying to get a job there.
I think we'll name this episode, "My Life is Like Forrest Gump."
Yeah. After 4 years of working summers and holidays in between college classes, I was fortunate enough to get a seasonal position and then fortunate enough to get a full-time trainer position, keeper position. And that's where it all started. And like I said, my Forrest Gump journey continued. I was really fortunate. The makeup of the staff there, I had two supervisors. His name was Randy Brill. He was a psychologist and really keen on the science of operant conditioning. And he immediately started getting me involved in the understanding the science, because I was going out there and trying to figure out what I needed to do to get the full-time job. So he said, "You need to understand the science." He immediately slapped a copy of Reynolds' Primer of Operant Conditioning on me. And I wouldn't recommend that to anyone, because it's a terrible way to get introduced to that science. It's just a hard read, but it kind of whet my appetite for, wow, there's a lot to this. I need to know more. But thankfully, I also had a really good supervisor. My direct supervisor, her name was Brenda Woodhouse, or Brenda Skinner at the time. And she was just the most amazing, intuitive trainer. I don't think she had a great understanding of the science, but she could train anything. She could read animals beautifully. So this wonderful package I had of the science on one shoulder and the art of training on the other shoulder, I think really helped me to develop a greater understanding of this whole discipline of animal training. And so I had the best of both worlds.
So this was 39 years ago.
Yep.
And you kind of just walked down to Brookfield and a couple of hours later you had a job.
I did. I was the 1% of 1% that just happened to be at the right place at the right time.
Well, I was going to say, do you, because when we were catching up a few weeks ago to discuss this episode, you told me that you're always attending workshops and you're always attending conferences and you're always looking for that little gem of information that someone who others might perceive as less experienced and less knowledgeable than you might bring to your training and to your application of what you do. So thinking about what you said to me outside of this recording and thinking about you just said there you're the 1% of the 1% that was lucky enough to get that job. Do you think it's luck with you, or do you think that in your experience you've worked hard and you've sought out those opportunities and we're just calling it luck? Does that question make sense?
It does, for sure. I think luck had a little bit to do with it, but where I got to today had a lot to do with my mentors giving me really good advice. And one piece that you kind of alluded to there was my Randy Brill said, you know, Tim, the best thing you can do for yourself is get the hell out of Brookfield Zoo as much as you can. Go out there, go to different facilities, training facilities, different marine mammal facilities, watch how they do things, learn their culture, learn the art and how they apply the science to animals, because you'll see different animals, you'll see different species, you'll see different individuals within a species. And I took that to heart, and I took probably for nearly 15 years, I would use my own holiday, my own vacation, and my own money to go work at a marine mammal facility for a week or two, whatever they would allow me to do. I'd sign away my life in some form so that if I got hurt, you know, they weren't responsible. But I'd just go there and I'd do everything. I'd be a slave, you know, but to whatever it took to watch them and listen in on their training meetings, attend their training sessions, watch their performances, watch how they work with animals. And in doing that, I developed over time this breadth of experience, some good experiences that I would replicate and some that were a part of my memory that I knew that this wasn't the way we should be going. And so it was kind of my own mental library of what this business is all about and how having that breadth of experience is really important, because a lot of people start in one place and they may work there for 10 years, but all they really know is that particular institution's culture, that how that institution does training. And I think you can't call yourself an expert, because the sliver of which you're an expert in is too small to really be meaningful to the rest of the community.
So did you ever go away and find somewhere and go, holy smokes, I'm trying not to swear on this podcast. Holy smokes, we're doing it a different way at Brookfield Zoo, but this way is better, and then kind of have to bring information back to Brookfield Zoo? Or was it always like, how did it work?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit of everything. Of course, at the time, the big 800-pound gorilla in marine mammal world was SeaWorld. And so I spent a lot of time there. And what I found from that particular institution as they had, you know, hundreds of animal trainers. And so they have lots of formality and structure in their training programs that ensured that all these trainers were operating the same way. They were using the terminology properly. They're communicating in effective ways. And so we were a small institution back at Brookfield. There were just five of us that worked there. So we didn't have that much formality in how we did programs. So I said, there might be some benefit in this. In other institutions, I saw, although they might have a lack of informality, the way they structured their training sessions, the amount of time and how they worked with their animals were things that I could bring back and say, hey, listen, we're struggling with this particular behavior or this animal's predilections. Maybe we can try this that I saw at this institution. So it was really a lot of cross-pollination. And so it was really helpful.
And so a couple of things. I'm curious to learn. We've had other people on this podcast show who have been at a zoological organization for similar periods of time. One that comes to mind is Anita Peterson from Copenhagen Zoo, who's yep. been there, I think, equally as long as you've been at Brookfield Zoo. And I'm curious to ask you, you know, what are some of the biggest lessons you've learned from staying with one organization for that period? But we're jumping ahead a little bit there, because I'm really also love to hear about stories that stick out in your mind. So specifically thinking back to your early days when you had those two mentors. You had this big textbook you're reading and you're observing your other supervisor showing you their application. And then you started to train and you started to get some actual hands-on experience. What are one or two stories that really stick out to you from that time?
Wow. So my supervisor, Randy, was a he was a guy that really wanted you to experience all aspects of the training process in a very practical way. So one of the stories that sticks out, and I tell a lot of people because I don't think it happens a lot in institutions, nor maybe is it, I won't say unethical, but it would create some problematic situations. So for instance, one of the first behaviors I was assigned to train was a dolphin tail wave, where they wave their flukes up and down above the water, which many of your listeners might have seen if they've gone to a dolphin show in the past. So I worked hard, I trained it, and I was so proud of it. And so I called my boss over. I said, "Randy, look, here it is." And I gave the cue for the behavior. The animal did it. I bridged and I fed a fish, and I was so proud. And he goes, "Great, Tim. Now extinguish it." And I'm like, "What?" He goes, "Extinguish it. Make it go away." And I'm like, "Okay." And he just walked away. And so I knew a little bit about extinction. So I went ahead and I kept cueing the behavior and didn't reinforce it over time. And pretty soon the animal said, "See ya." And they took off, and the behavior was no longer there. And so I called my boss over and said, "You know, I extinguished the behavior." He goes, "Great, bring it back." And so I had to bring it back. And so surprisingly, if you understand about extinction, resurgence, the behavior came back pretty quickly, and I got it back under stimulus control, showed Randy again. He goes, "Awesome, change the cue." And so it was just this constant evolution of applying different techniques to the same behavior to kind of force me to learn and take risks where, you know, to extinguish a behavior or to change a cue oftentimes would just come up organically because you're forced to do it. But now I have this new set of skills in my quiver that I could use. And I didn't understand the kind of his reasoning behind that. But looking back, I'm like, wow, what a great opportunity that I may never do with any of my trainers. But I think there's benefit in practicing those things that you read in the books and actually going through the process to develop the practical experience.
And I feel like a lot of trainers, you know, and like you say, you might not do that in 2019, but even if you did, like, that would be a struggle for a lot of people. But how did you go about it? Like, and so let's think about how you went about it then, and maybe hypothesize that you kind of go about problems now in the same way. You got a challenge thrown at you and you had to solve it. What was your strategy? And is it the same now? Like, did you learn kind of problem solving from that, or?
I love problem solving. That's one of my favorite things to do. As I always tell my students or my keepers, if you don't like to solve problems, you're in the wrong business. Because, you know, managing behavior and animal training, it's never set. Once you've done something, you have an animal that's performing and responding properly, the environment just steps in front of you and says, "Nope, you're not done yet," and you have to keep fixing it. And so developing the skills like extinguishing behavior and changing cues and all those different aspects of training are really helpful to actually practice and have that with you, because now I'm not afraid of them. You know, if I were to come in and have never practically extinguish a behavior or change a cue, and I'm telling someone else to do that, I don't know if I would have the same comfort in doing it, nor the same ability to teach it. And so I think that was a wonderful opportunity for me to work with different aspects of training, have it accomplished in a practical way, so that I can then share it with people as a mentor now.
And one more question just before we move on to some of the other topics we're going to talk about in this podcast. I've already asked the question, so just going back 39 years, what are the three biggest things you've learned from staying in one organization, seeing it evolve, seeing the training programs evolve, seeing the training techniques evolved, seeing the industry as a whole evolve? What are some of the biggest things you've learned? Zoning into kind of training specifically and animal training and behavior.
Right. Seen a lot. I think I came in at a really important time in training history, maybe specifically in marine mammal training history, but there was a lot of skill and a lot of desire to make incremental improvements to our training as a community. And so starting in the 80s, we started seeing in the marine mammal community a real strong influence of science. And people in the community, especially in SeaWorld and in my institution at Brookfield, really pushing science and developing the same vocabulary, getting away from jargon, that because the jargon was different at all different facilities, and using the proper terminology that's in the textbooks so that we could all communicate the same way and communicate more effectively. We started going from fixed schedules of reinforcement, one-on-one continuous schedules, to testing variable ratio schedules. My boss, Randy Brill, was instrumental in that. Along with SeaWorld, we started developing and implementing using variable ratio schedules in marine mammals. And it was a wonderful opportunity. There was so much going on and everyone trying to implement these things. So that was a huge change. Following that, we started to see that there was a generational change happening, as well as new trainers were coming in. They were being raised with science in their background. And so they were going in deeper into the science and trying to find more applications for how to do our jobs better. The use of, the target was pretty brand new back in the 70s, using targeting techniques and getting away from free shaping, which I want to talk about later because I think we've maybe gone too far. But that was how we applied those. And then the biggest change of all was when we started to work on voluntary medical behaviors or husbandry behaviors. I remember the exact day and where I was when I saw a videotape of someone taking a blood sample voluntarily from a killer whale. And there was four of us standing around this video machine going, oh my God, this is really important. Because, I started a second before I saw that video, all I wanted to do was train the best, most amazing dolphin performance behavior, a triple flip with, triple twists and that type of thing. Because that was what people wanted. That was your currency as a trainer in the marine mammal field, is these wonderful, showy behaviors. And then I saw something I thought was completely impossible and saw it happen in front of my eyes, and it changed everything for me. I said, this is what we need to be doing. And then we had to make the decision of how do we now split our time between still doing performances and doing show behaviors with the marine mammals and incorporating this new aspect of helping them take care of themselves, to provide medical care to them in ways that they volunteer their in a cooperative way. And so there was a lot of give and take with that. How do we do more with the same amount of trainers and the same amount of time? And so we had to become more efficient. And I think that in itself was the biggest change, and it continues to grow. Just when we thought we saw the most amazing husbandry behavior, somebody does something even more crazy and pushes the envelope even higher. And so I've given up thinking there's a ceiling, because someone's going to say, there is no ceiling, I'm going to try it because no one's going to tell me otherwise. And they do it. And it just pushes the science and the discipline farther.
I'm always reminded of the story where someone says you couldn't run the 100 meters and X amount of time, and then someone did it, and then suddenly everyone did it. But like, until someone actually does it, sometimes it holds us back. So it's nice to hear you share that, and that's a lesson that you've taken from those 39 years. And I am excited that we get to share that lesson with the listeners of this show, because I think it's an important one. So thank you so much for sharing. Yeah. Hey, for the listeners of this show, can you just share a little bit, just before we move on, about Brookfield Zoo, about what Brookfield Zoo represents in 2019, and kind of where people can go to find Brookfield Zoo online and find that information if they're visiting Chicago, et cetera.
Sure. Yeah, we're a bigger zoo in the United States. It's hard to say who's biggest, because you don't know what you're talking about. You're talking about the size of the facility. You're talking about the operation budget, but we're a larger zoo. And we have always been focused on conservation and creating conservation leadership in our guests to try and inspire people to care about animals and nature. And so all of our programming, all of our exhibition of the animals is geared towards, when we bring guests, the 2 million guests into Brookfield Zoo every year, they leave with a caring attitude, empathy for animals, because really you're not going to change your own behavior unless you feel attached and engaged with animals. And so you got to create that step first. And so all of what we do, and whether we're in my training programs, in how we display animals, how we provide environmental enrichment to show our best, the best of the animals, their natural behavior. That's all geared towards making sure that when any of our 2 million guests show up, that we create a connection that will hopefully inspire them to, when they leave the zoo, to do something small for the planet and for animals, whether it's in your own local neighborhood or spending some money and giving money to a noble cause out there that's trying to help the, you know, conserve the planet and conserve animals. So it's a pretty cool place, and that's why I stayed there. I felt connected. I've had opportunities to go other places, but I feel it's important that you see that what you're doing, you have a passion for the job, but you also have a passion for the mission of the organization you work for.
That was pretty special, I think, what you said there. I could feel it in your voice, the passion. And so thank you for sharing that. And I would love to one day hopefully get over to Brookfield Zoo. I've heard amazing things. And so the website is just brookfield.com. What's .org?
You can get there at Brookfield Zoo, but formerly it's CZS, or Chicago Zoological Society, right. .org.
Okay, cool. And we'll link to this in the show notes, everyone, so you can easily navigate there. Hey, thanks so much for sharing all of that so far, Tim. We call that part of the podcast People's Behavior Odysseys, and I love learning about those. Moving forward, I'd really like to talk about a label that you and I discussed in our pre-podcast catch-up, and that is resilience, and how you train resilience with zoo animals. So, Tim, to start this part off, can you maybe offer the listeners a definition of what resilience is? What kind of behaviors are associated with this?
How to come up with a concise definition. Resilience actually is... maybe it's a measurement of an animal's ability to cope with change and failure and come back and continue on with a good attitude and wanting to continue to respond. Every animal, as you know, animals within a species, even our own species, have different kind of temperaments and ability to respond to change and to respond from either trauma or some negative event in their life and continue on without a bad attitude, just to be healthy, have a healthy psychological and emotional state after they experience failure or something traumatic that has affected them. So resilience, as I see it, is something that is a good trait in people and in animals. And it's something that is easily, I think, easily modified. And of course, I'm talking about increasing resilience providing an animal with kind of their own armor plating to life's kind of little things that they throw in your way, little challenges, little hurdles, and being able to bounce back as quick as possible so you can get back onto living. So I always talk about this when I consult or I talk to my trainers, because it doesn't matter how good of a trainer you are and how confident you are that you can create environments that animals are going to be comfortable in, things are going to happen out of your control. Animals are going to experience bad things, whether in your training sessions or in their life outside of training. They're going to experience negative situations as a result of socializing with members of their own kind or other animals that happen to live around them or with them. And so we have to learn how to deal with how negative experiences can affect animals, help to build their armor plate. But when they take a hit, we have to find a way to get them back and build that resiliency back up in them so to make them more adept at dealing with it in the future.
So how do we go about building resilience, providing animals with these armor platings, as you put it? How do we go about doing this in the zoo world?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different phases in which you do that. The first of all is that you like to do it early in an animal's life. When a young animal is born, they are a sponge and they are starting to gain a catalog of experiences. And we want to make sure that in that time when they're open to anything, that we offer them lots of different looks and feels of their environment, so they don't come into a static environment and grow up in a static environment, because then they're going to be least likely to be comfortable with change. So I think in the dog world, we call it socialization. I got another puppy from a shelter. We go out there and try and find dogs that are in really a bad place behaviorally. And I feel like I can do some service and bring dogs back in and help them out. We've done it a couple times. This time though, the world has changed because of litigation, and I have two small children, and they wouldn't let me take a messed up dog home anymore. So the kids were like, but we have to leave with a dog. And so we ended up with a puppy. But they gave me a document that I had never seen before, and it was called the Puppy Rules of 12. And it was this beautiful document about exposing your puppy to change over their first 12 weeks of their life. You know, feed them in 12 different places out of 12 different bowls, expose them to 12 different people, take them to 12 different places in your car, that type of thing, where they're getting exposure. And along this route, these exposures are good. They're making positive associations because you are an important part of their life, a positive influence. If you act calm and relaxed around them, so will they. And so we just start, that's where you have to start building resilience, is in a young animal. And so that's super important, because you can't get that developmental window back. That it starts to close later on. It's not that you can't change it, it just becomes harder. So that's, I think, a really important part, is we have that in our training plans, that when we have young animals come into our collection, whether they're born there or they come in as part of a program, you have building that socialization, if we want to use that term, or building resilience by making sure they aren't in a static environment. We're always providing change in front of them. Our interactions with them are different every day. And this is, we can structure this. It doesn't have to be chaotic. We can just create a calendar of, we're going to introduce these animals to this thing today, or this new place, or this new concept, and just keep it rolling. And you'll start to see that those animals will be super resilient right from the starting block. And I think that's the best thing you can do. But unfortunately, that's not how we always start our careers with animals, or find them. Sometimes we find animals that are adults. They've had a history that we may know very little about, and we can still try and build that resilience in, and still make sure that they're living in dynamic, positive environments that makes them help cope with some of the negative things that will eventually happen.
Cool. We're gonna use your gorillas as an example today, but maybe before we go to that specific example, do you have any protocols or standard approaches you take to helping an adult that you might come into contact with, or might come into your care and at Brookfield Zoo, that might not be showing behaviors we would call resilient? What would you do in that situation?
Yeah, so those are the ones where you really earn your money, and you start to draw on some techniques that are familiar to us, but become very important when you have an animal that is not confident anymore. They are starting to shy away from engaging in normal activity. And of course, that can be across a large spectrum, from really an animal that's really disturbed and dysfunctional, to those that kind of spook and react to specific stimuli that they've had a bad experience with. Either way, you have to start looking for ways to build their confidence back up, to build up back up that resilience. So we reach into our bag of tricks and use good desensitization and counter conditioning techniques. We go right back into Pavlov, and we start to make associations with things, bringing animals to their flight or fight threshold, the FFT, and you want to keep them kind of right there, bring them up to a point where they're just showing a little bit of discomfort. And then oftentimes, if you can, if they're willing to take some positive reinforcement, some food or some other tactile reinforcement to get them caught when they're showing the chance to get relaxed, great. If they're not, you're falling into the realm of negative reinforcement then. So the best thing you can do is wait for the animal to relax a little bit, and then you remove the aversive stimulus from them, which negatively reinforces their relaxing and calming down in its presence. And as you continue to make those repetitions and trials, this might be preaching to the choir here, but you'll start to notice that the animal's threshold, that FFT threshold, will start to grow. They'll start to get more comfortable with that stimulus. And of course, you may have to repeat that process with other things that they find aversive. But what you'll see is over time, if you show the animals that relaxing, calming down in the presence of this stimulus ends up in some type of reinforcement in a good experience, their confidence starts to grow. And of course, all this time, we're making sure that they're well in control. If they want to escape, they can escape. If they want to approach, great, we're going to reinforce them for that. But we have to be very conscientious of where they're at behaviorally and only making progressions when the animal's showing us signs that they're ready for it. And so this is just a process that keeps going, and you'll start to notice that the animal starts to generalize these bad things, and they start to trust you that things that you're bringing them or places that you're going to bring them are going to end up with a good experience or a neutral experience as opposed to negative ones. And so when you start to gain that trust, then they're more open to looking at things from a positive mental attitude versus that negative bias that we're all born with from an evolutionary standpoint.
And so, like I said, we're going to talk about this with gorillas. Before we do, because I want to kind of focus on that as our main example, but can you think of any other examples that stick out in your mind of where you've had to really reach for those tools in your experience?
Oh, gosh. There's so many. I can't seem to focus on one now. Yeah, a lot of the places you're going to see this at, I'll give you an example. There's a class of animals in zoos called ambassador animals. I don't know if it's familiar to you, but these are animals that are their job, their role in a zoological institution is to go out to outside of their home habitat and go in to interact with people in the zoo, doing media events, going to classrooms to work with kids. And so these animals get exposed to lots of dynamic experiences and things that we can't control, like screaming kids or kids that run up and try and grab their tails or whatever it is. And so we try and make these animals as resilient as possible. That's where you want to have the peak of resiliency of these animals that are going out into these unpredictable environments. So occasionally something bad happens. A kid does something silly, or you're in a TV studio and a camera falls or a light falls, and it creates this bit of trauma in the animal's life. And you find yourself back at square one. The animal doesn't want to leave their home base, and you have to start over again. And so this is where you have to say, okay, this is really bad, but as I've been told, all behavior is modifiable. And I'm going to go out there and use the tools I have and slowly bring this animal back to a good place. And that happens all the time with ambassador animals, but also with some of these medical behaviors we do. Sometimes we teach an animal to go into a squeeze crate, where we are able to physically kind of restrain the animal to give them a shot or to do a more invasive procedure. And what we find out is that if we've done our job right, if the preponderance of experiences inside that crate have been good ones, and we started out with being good experiences, that one bad experience is the exception and not the rule. And that's one of the greatest things I've learned is when you take an animal in a car or take them to a place or into a device that you may have to use that has aversive quality to it, the first experience sets the rule. It sets what that thing is all about, and you start to build strong reinforcement history. So when you have to do something undesirable to the animal doesn't relate it to that place or that crate. It relates it to something else. And so they immediately are willing to go right back in because that was the exception to the experience in that environment, that no circumstances.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks for sharing that. So let's jump now, because I know all the listeners are dying to hear, because I keep saying it. Let's jump to your gorilla example, because that's one that you mentioned to me that we could talk about in the episode today. So what were the, did you, I guess, is a more appropriate question to ask? Did you run into issues with the gorillas, or was your gorilla program did you just want to talk about how you set it up?
Yeah, no, it's one of those things where everything was going great. It's a really good program. The keepers, the trainers at my zoo do a fantastic job. The animals know lots of husbandry behaviors. They're very compliant. But sometimes things conspire that end up creating problems. We have a fairly large gorilla troop, and we do a lot of kind of planned physical examinations, usually annually, with these animals. The good news is that most of them will take a voluntary injection for being immobilized for the procedure, which is awesome. Not having to physically restrain an animal or use a dart. It has just so many wonderful characteristics. But what can happen is you might have a couple of planned physical examinations take place that you... After each one of these, there's a bit of regression by the animals. They do tend to associate those things with people, places, and times. And you might get a perfect storm like has happened to us, where you get a couple of physical examinations back to back, and then an animal or two gets sick, and then you have to do more physical examinations. And so all of a sudden, you see animals that are not very trusting of you or the areas in which those examinations took place. And so we found ourselves there, and the staff had reached out, and we said, well, okay, we have to go back. The animals are afraid of the doors now. Because sometimes to get animals separated, you have to close the doors on them, and not by their will. Because you have to do, when an animal's sick, you have to take care of them. And so you have to resort to those things that you don't want to do. So that breaks down your trust a little bit. That analogy of the trust bank, you take a big withdrawal from it, and you have to start building that bank account up again. And so it got to the point where the animals were not very trustworthy of doors closing. And so we're having that affects your management of the animals in future physical examinations. So I went down and said, you know what? I think we need to start from scratch here, and we really start to get animals trusting us and trusting the doors again. And that just came down to doing some really good desensitization. What had been happening is they would attempt to close the door as a part of a training process, and the animals would just not then cooperate after that, and they would end the session. The one thing I've learned over my time is that we have to consider the long-term goals instead of responding with a consequence you think is necessary for what you're seeing with the animal today. So we went back to just trying to create associations between door movement and good experiences, positive reinforcement. And so I said, regardless of what the animals do after that door closes, we're going to reinforce them when they come back, because that's the most important part. Don't care about what the animals do as a result of doors closing. I want to make sure that the animals are getting positive reinforcement every time a door moves. And we just start using classical conditioning again to build up the reinforcement history on those doors. And so that was one phase. The other phase is when animals start to get really reactive, the human nature is to try and control the environment as much as possible to create a comfortable routine for the animal. So if something, a fan is making noise, we think it's scaring the animals, you turn the fan off. But that fan's necessary for ventilation, so you're actually compromising maybe the ventilation, or you don't do certain things because you think it's going to scare the animals. And I look at things completely differently. If I see something the animal's afraid of, I don't try and rid that important stimuli from the environment. I want to get the animals used to it. So we went back to saying, let's just start, instead of making the environment static, let's make it more dynamic, but in a very thoughtful, strategic way. So the plan was every day something new was going to take place for these animals, in addition to us opening and closing doors. And so that's where we're at today. The staff is really encouraged. We've seen incredible change with the animals. They're becoming very comfortable. We were able to work with our veterinary staff to delay the next upcoming physical examination, which has no negative consequence on the animal. It's just a scheduling thing, but it gives us more time to continue to build up that reinforcement history so that when we go ahead and do that physical examination in a couple months, the animals are going to be more resilient and will recover from that quite quickly, so we can continue on with our training program and resilience building operations. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And so I think it does. I've often thought things have made sense in this podcast and then realize I have no idea what I'm talking about. So this program with introducing all of this novelty, is it paired with doors moving, or is it just novelty on a daily basis? Both.
It's both, yeah. So we want to move different doors. I want to look at, people... the routine was everyone had to be sitting when they're in front of an animal, because standing was seen as dangerous. And I said, great, well, let's, instead of never standing again during a training session, which, you know, kind of reduces your functionality as a trainer, let's start, you know, standing up as a part of it and reinforcing animals for being comfortable with us standing up, being able to move animals from one place to another, to cross by an animal, to be able to have more flexibility. We just build all of that into our daily training plan. And we schedule this out over a month period of time. And if the animals respond well to a conservative move, we may jump a couple of approximations because we know they're ready for it, because they're showing us they're becoming more comfortable. And that was one of the things I told the keepers in advance. I said, I know this sounds really laborious because I'm a splitter. I like to do things very conservatively. But since we have a plan of what the next 10 or 15 or 30 steps are, when the animals are showing me that they're starting to generalize and become comfortable with change in general, we can start making bigger leaps. And so we're in the process of making bigger leaps now. And so the resilience building operation is gaining much more speed and velocity as I anticipated, but sometimes it's hard to tell people that that's going to happen. And it gives you a little bit of street credibility when they actually see it happening in front of their eyes.
And so before the gorillas in question had the repetitive medical procedures occurring to them, at which point you saw the regression, is that a correct word? The going backwards of their behavior, yep, right, with regards to dog. Had you done this program before that, or just been implemented after that?
This was implemented after the fact. This was a group of animals that the staff was quite comfortable with their progress. But their housing, their night quarters is very, very different. It's located below the habitat in a very quiet area of the zoo where very little interference, and it's can be a very static environment if you don't make those changes yourself. And so the animals were kind of housed in a situation that made them less comfortable with change because very little change happened. Conversely, our orangutan group was up in a central location of the facility where the kitchen was, and workers go by every day, and they are just resilient just because of where they're located. So the gorillas were kind of predisposed to being less resilient just because of where their night quarters were. And so the staff had adjusted somewhat to that, but I had always wanted to go in there to try and build it up because it was something that showed up 20 years ago, but it wasn't really hampering their training. They're doing great stuff. But at this point, it seemed like we had this problem, and let's use this as an opportunity to do what I wanted to do many years ago and build these animals up to be in a more resilient state, because their night quarters aren't going to change. So we have to build that into the system now and make sure it sustains itself as a part of our protocols.
Yeah, cool. So that helps me understand, I think, and hopefully the listeners of the show. So then the vision, if you will, looking forward into the future now, we've implemented this program. If we find an animal has to go through, once again, a repetitive set of procedures, medical procedures that we might label as aversive to them, we might predict it's going to be rather unpleasant. The prediction is with this training, this resilience training, that they're going to bounce back from that faster because of the variability? Or is that correct?
They'll bounce back quicker because it will have less of a psychological, emotional effect on them because it's just one of many changes. And what we do is say that when something bad happens, doesn't predict that it's going to continue to be bad, that it can be brought back to a positive or neutral state for the animal. And they start to trust in the fact that life isn't just constantly throwing negative things at them, that this stuff happens. And I don't want to be anthropomorphic, but you can develop animals a feeling of self-confidence in their ability to control their environment and bounce back from these negative experiences with our help. We can show them by strategically using good desensitization techniques, good counter conditioning, and then of course developing a program that once we create resiliency, it doesn't end there. You have to maintain it. It's very easy to fall back in routines. It's an unfortunate part of human nature is routines are efficient. We can turn off our brains and just go into autopilot. It happens in any career. But when you're doing it with animals and you need their behavior and need them to be resilient, you have to protect against static environments and falling into routines. Change has to be a constant part of life because the animals will learn to accept that challenge and learn that they can actually thrive in it.
it's like a never-ending training challenge for all animals and all trainers everywhere, all of the time.
It is. It's a good investment in time. And once you set it up, it's not a different layer. It's just how you operate in your training programs, and it becomes quite simple.
It's not a different layer. It's just how you operate. I like that. Hey, that was a lot of fun to learn about. We've got a few more topics before we finish up the episode for today. So I'm really keen to talk about this next one. We're gonna shift focus now rather abruptly, everyone. So stay with us. For this next topic, I want to talk about something that, like I said, influences all of us. And by us, I mean humans. This next topic influences animal trainers and non-animal trainers alike, although we're going to talk about how to use it to help your animal training today. So it's something that influences you, the listener, and you might not even be aware of it. And this is self-fulfilling prophecies. Dum, dum, dum. Tim, can you tell the listeners of this show, what do we mean when we say self-fulfilling prophecies, and why this is something that you felt you would really like this opportunity to discuss on the show today?
Sure. A self-fulfilling prophecy is basically when we're entering into a situation, whether it's a training session or a date with a new person or any experience, we come in with some expectations. And sometimes those expectations are negative, sometimes they're positive. But unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, evolutionarily, we all end up with a negative bias, a negativity bias, where we protect against negative things. So sometimes we come into new and novel and scary situations with a negative expectation, a negative prediction of how that's going to turn out. And because of that attitude that we bring in, that negative attitude, it shows up in our behavior. And so what we do is we actually act in a way that helps make that expectation, that prophecy come true, just because of how we are perceived by those that we interact with in that situation. And so when that happens, it reinforces our prediction. And so it creates this terrible cycle of, well, of course, look, I knew this was going to go bad. It went bad. I'm so smart. And if it happens again, it's going to go bad again. And so it's this terrible downward cycle that one can find themselves in. Likewise, we can develop negative prophecies about things due to labels that are given to animals and things that other information we get from secondhand parties that say, hey, be careful, or, you know, you're working with an aggressive animal here. The second you get that label or that prediction that someone else makes, you internalize it. And again, it can show in your behavior that can be then perceived by the animal, and that prophecy can come true just because of you're thinking about it. So these are things that I learned firsthand as a juvenile or junior marine mammal trainer. I think I mentioned a story to you about my first experience with self-fulfilling prophecy was with the Marine Mammal Trainers Association. They have an annual conference, and we hosted it at Brookfield Zoo. And of course, you have 300 or 400 of the best trainers in the world show up at your facility, and you have to do a show for them, and your animals have to perform. And it's kind of scary and stressful. And so it was my job to go out there and do that performance. And sure enough, the first set of behaviors I asked for from the animals went crazy. The animals blew up, and there was a bout of aggression that took place, and everything just kind of went downhill. That was my perception of it, because I was so nervous and wanted everything to go so well. My colleagues all said the show was fine, and they really enjoyed it. But thankfully, a couple of my colleagues from SeaWorld, really good trainers, came up to me after the show, and they saw that I was not very happy. I was kind of depressed. And they said, hey, Tim, come on, let's go have a beer. And they said, you know, listen, we saw what happened there and saw you were depressed, and you had some problems with your animal's behavior. And we just wanted to know if you've ever heard of something called self-fulfilling prophecy before. And I said, oh, yeah, I've heard it, you know, but I thought it was, you know, something mystical, or I really didn't understand it. And they said, yeah, but, you know, it has a really big influence on your training. And they went ahead and explained the whole process of how it works and how it affects behavior. And over time, it really started to make sense to me. And I've since learned to both teach my trainers about it, and I've actually developed an entire presentation on self-fulfilling prophecy, because it won't make you a better trainer. You still have to have great skills. You still have to work on that aspect. But this is one of those enhancements that any trainer can use and think about. This knowledge helps you walk into training situations in the right frame of mind to make sure that you're going to have the best possible success in setting the animal up to succeed. And so I think it's a really important thing for people to realize. It happens to everyone. We walk into our training sessions with expectations. And if those expectations are negative, if we've been given a label by our colleagues, or we are looking at how they're acting just before the training session and making a projection that that's going to have a negative impact on our training session, we can actually create that prophecy, because our bodies are going to show it to the animals. And that's important, because we're so important to our animals. We do everything for them. We provide them comfort and safety and reinforcement. We've developed these strong relationships and bonds. And so they pay really close attention to us, and animals do their jobs 24/7. We only see them, you know, for several hours out of the day. And evolutionarily, they're very keen to pick up on subtleties in the behavior of those around them. And they start to learn our subtleties and things when we look uncomfortable, and that can change their behavior. So it's important that we walk into all of our training sessions with a positive frame of mind. And that's the greatest counter to self-fulfilling prophecy, because it works both ways. If you have positive expectations walking into a training session, you will exude that in your how you're perceived by the animal, and then more likely to produce positive results because you've already projected that into the future. So I give my trainers little exercises that work for anyone, and it's not just for animal training. Some of the best things to do is, before you walk into a training session, is really walk through it in your mind. Visualize if you have a set of approximations you're going to go through, or you have to use a target and manipulate the animal with a target, that you've already worked that through in your head. If you've watched Olympic divers or Olympic gymnasts, right before they go out to do their routine, sometimes you'll see them closing their eyes, and they're kind of in their head, they're practicing the dive they're about to do. Sometimes they move, and you can see them kind of working out what the twist is. And this is how they're projecting the future, that they're doing a perfect dive versus crashing and burning into the water. Psychologists have said the way to make these positive visualizations as strong as possible is to think about incorporating different senses into it, more senses. So you visualize you're doing it right. What does a successful behavior sound like? Are there sounds in the environment that are associated with the animal doing the right thing? Is there a smell? That type of thing. So you incorporate all the senses that you will experience when the behavior goes perfectly. If you've already visualized that, then you bring it into the session and have a better chance of recreating it right there in front of you.
So if we were to come and watch Tim Sullivan do a training session at Brookfield Zoo, we would see him stand to the sidelines and close his eyes and start to pretend to click. And it's what I'm asking you is this something that you have consciously built into your practice as a trainer? Are you doing this process before each training session, or do you find it's kind of like a tool in your tool bag that when you need it, you reach for it type of thing?
Right. After a while, at first it seems kind of silly and in very mechanical, but what happens over time is the best thing you can do as a trainer, and again, take this out of training, take it as a life skill as well, because a lot of things we do in training are great life skills, but what you do is protect against negative thoughts creeping into your mind. When you hear someone trying to inadvertently influence you with giving an animal a label or skewing your perception of what's going to happen in the future, you go, nope, I'm not going to let that into my brain. I'm going to keep thinking the positive thoughts. And you kind of protect yourself against those negative thoughts when a red flag goes off in your head, and you immediately put yourself back into visualizing the perfect solution. The perfect training session that you're about to undertake.
Protect against negative thoughts creeping into your mind. So it's kind of like building resilience.
It is. These things are all tied. They're all tied together.
So the more situations you can practice that in, the more naturally it will come to you, and the more easily you're going to be able to bounce back from traumatic training sessions, those ones where you're too tired and you shouldn't be training, but you go in and you leave frustrated. And
yeah, you know, you give yourself a little self-affirmation, you know, say, you know, I'm good at this. And don't focus on the bad thing that just happened, because A, that doesn't predict the future. And B, it doesn't define you as a trainer. If you're worth a trainer worth your salt, you've had many, many more positive experiences in training and good results that you should be focusing on, and not just the negative one that just happened. And so if you can get yourself back on track and with a little self-affirmation, you can then move on from a mistake that you made or the animal made, and not let that be a predictor for the rest of your session.
Sage advice there with Tim Sullivan. Hey, thank you so much for sharing that. One last question, one question we ask everyone, and I'm super keen to hear your offering on this today, Tim. Based on your experience in the vast and colorful amount of animals and species and situations you've found yourself in, you've seen a lot of change. We've talked about some of that today. You're training new things today in your role with your keepers and the animals at your organization. So, and we've kind of had you paint a picture of where we are today as well. This question, though, I want to think into the future. What do you really want to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years? Where do you see us taking all of this stuff that we're doing now and taking it to the next level? What does that look like? Close your eyes and tell me the visual representation of what the future looks like for you.
Yeah, you know, if I were to take one stab at what we should be doing over the next 5 or 10 years, I've seen a change in training over my some 40 years. When I got into animal training back in the early 1980s, we were just leaving an age where trainers didn't know anything about targets and prompts. They free shaped everything. They sat there with a bucket of food and their whistle, and they waited for the animals to do something that was close to the approximation they're looking for, and they blew their whistle, and then they shaped the behavior. What I've seen today is that, which is kind of showing itself in society too, is we're trying to protect our animals from every bad thing, from all failure. And I see now a lot of animals that aren't thinking as much as they should be. They're not solving the problem themselves, because we want to make sure they never fail, which is nearly impossible to do. So we're constantly offering hints and prompts to make sure they succeed. And that's great. But unfortunately, we have animals that are then just looking for the answers to come from us, and they're not thinking about solving their own problem. So I think in the future, and I've done this a couple times at my zoo, I've challenged trainers to put their targets down and to stop providing endless prompts to the animal when they don't get the approximation right away, and just pause for a second and let the animal try and figure it out. I try and say we're trying to create not only resilience, the animal gets comfortable with a little bit of failure, but they also are comfortable trying to solve the problem themselves. Because an animal that can solve its own problems is going to be more resilient, back to resiliency, but they're also going to make a better student. Because what I found is that animals that are afraid of failure, as trainers are afraid of failure, they sometimes aren't motivated because of they want to succeed. They want to are motivated because they don't want to avoid failure. And I think that changes your attitude about the learning process. I want animals and trainers to be comfortable with letting their animals take a second to figure things out themselves, because I think that makes them a better student. And this has to be built into our training systems. I want people to put their targets down and try to learn to free shape something simple. Let the animal learn that if they didn't hear the next marker they expected, that they're willing to try again, that they're willing to not only try again, but they're going to modify their behavior a little bit to try and find out what it is they have to do to get you to click your clicker or blow your whistle. And an animal that's willing to think and try and to change their strategy on their own without a prompt is going to be a much better student. And I think more likely to be able to move through new acquisition of behavior more quickly and with more fluidity. And I think that's going to be very helpful. So I think we prompts are great. Making sure the animals succeed is one thing, but not at the expense of stopping them from thinking, always trying to give them the answers. Animals, thinking animals are going to be much better students, and they're going to enjoy training a lot better because it gives them more control over success versus always relying on us to give them the answers.
Well, you just offered topics for a whole nother episode there, Tim, so thanks for that. To try to sum it up in a couple of sentences, put your targets down sometimes. Let the animals try and figure it out, because an animal that can solve its own problem is going to be more resilient, but they're also going to make a better student. Have I summed
right.
it up?
You've summed it up, yeah. And make sure your training plans that you're putting together, sometimes the professional trainers, people that are on your ATA, your tribe, are really good trainers, and they're really ambitious. And we're constantly pushing. We're always, the animals are, we're trying to do more and more things. But if you go back to university or college, imagine if every class you took was organic chemistry or physics. How would you enjoy learning then if it was always hard? So it's okay to do those hard things, but make sure you mix in some fun as well, so that the animal, you know, comes to the training session and not always, say, oh God, this is gonna be hard. I've really got to work through this. Sometimes just put some fun things in there, things that have a high rate of reinforcement built in. Play the training game with them, the shaping game, so you can hone your bridging, your marking skills, and those things. The animal just learns to do something different and reinforce something different just because it's different. This way, the whole process of learning is fun and enjoyable, and something that animals look forward to. If you have an animal that's engaged and loves learning, is waiting for you to show up with your training tools, then you know you're creating a good student, not just a good behavior. And I think that's the biggest overall concept we should be shooting for, because no trainer or training program is going to be identified by one single behavior. They're going to be identified by the students that they create, the learners that they create, and they have learners that enjoy that process. That's how I judge a good training program. The animals are just ready to go.
Then you know you are training a good student, not just a good behavior. Love it. Hey, Tim, that does bring us to the end of this episode now. We could go on and on and on, and my list of questions is much larger than the time availability we have to do this recording today. So we will head towards the end. Tim, this has been so much fun. From myself and on behalf of everyone listening today, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
And everyone listening today as well, thank you. We appreciate you tuning in. If you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnish, choice-rich ways, training resilience in all of them, then as mentioned at the start of the episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior nerds. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.